This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on PodClips. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views of the most experienced and accomplished mediators and others experienced in the process. Through our discussions, you will gain insight into how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Lynn litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998 and is a member of the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution each year since 2014. And now your host, Lynn Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us on Season 4 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast which will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals and ADR Services, Inc. In each podcast episode, you've been hearing a story about a conflict, the impact that conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and the lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Many of the details of the story you are about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality essential to mediation while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Today, I've got to control myself to not spend too much time on the introduction because I could spend 40 minutes on introducing Pat Kelly. Pat is, he's just an extraordinary mediator following a career as an extraordinary attorney. He is one of the preeminent trial lawyers, litigators, law firm leaders, and professional association leaders in this country. He's been president of the California Bar, president of the Los Angeles County Bar, a member of ABOTA. I could go on. And he has vast experience in a wide variety of areas that he brings to the mediation. I mean, his experience is really unparalleled, I think. He has a feel for effectively and economically resolving matters as a mediator. He's also an arbitrator and a referee. And during his lengthy career, Pat has tried, litigated, arbitrated, mediated, and or settled thousands of cases involving many areas of the law. And on top of all of that, Pat has also found time to pursue a passion not in the legal field. He's found time to play lead guitar, I believe, with the Beach Boys. And he has recently performed with the Lawyers Philharmonic. And if you haven't heard Pat's version of Wipeout, you're missing something. So, Pat, welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution.
Thank you, Len. It's an honor to be here today. I wanted to really put something together using case examples of matters I've handled that would be very helpful to your audience in a number of ways. And the area I'm going to focus on primarily is examples of the use of a mediator's recommendation and a mediator's proposal. Just a brief introduction. What I mean by that is a mediator's recommendation is oral. It's not binding. But it is a mediator's evaluation of a proposal that might bring the parties together and get them talking. This will really be illustrated in the segment I'm going to go through today. Contrast that with a mediator's proposal, which is written into specific terms. It's really an offer by the mediator to both sides that can be accepted by both sides. Requires a written acceptance and may be enforceable. And to any of your readers who have a pencil and a pen ready, I'd like to read quickly some sections that will should be read to fully understand how this works. Evidence Code Section 1123, Evidence Code Section 1118 and CCP Section 664.6. Now, I'm going through a case study that embodies all of the characteristics that need to be come together to utilize those types of resolution vehicles. So with that, I'd like to get started. Case study that involves a 30-year saga of a deceased wealthy entrepreneur, an estate plan that involved her estate, her husband, and her children, a deceased first husband, a remarriage, a dispute over the disposition of the estate between the second husband and the children of the first marriage. And as you would expect, somehow in all of this, lawyers are sued and fees are claimed. So that is the background of today's saga. All right, let me go into some basic facts so you understand how this came together. The decedent was a wealthy entrepreneur, and she and her husband had an estate plan drawn by, for purposes of our discussion, law firm A. And that plan benefited her husband and children. Many years later, her husband died, and the decedent entrepreneur married husband number two and had a new estate plan drawn by law firm B that incorporated some provisions and definitions from the original plan prepared by law firm A. Decedent then died, and law firm B, who was then acting as her probate firm, distributed the estate assets in accordance with what they believed was the correct construction of the estate plan they drafted. But as you would expect, the children brought an action against husband number two and had a dispute claiming that they were in fact entitled to some of the estate because of the manner in which the original estate plan was drafted. The second husband hired law firm C to litigate the suit with the children. That case was ultimately settled, the case with the children, but the story doesn't end there. The husband then sued law firm A, claiming that law firm A erred in drafting the original estate plan, which resulted in an ambiguity which opened the door for the claim of the children. That claim was ultimately dismissed on statute of limitations grounds. He also sued law firm B, the probate firm, claiming that law firm B erred in not correcting the erroneous estate plan provisions and bringing a timely action against law firm A. Finally, he brought an action against law firm C, the people who represented him in the action against the children, for not filing an action against law firm B and somehow not getting by the claim by the children dismissed. In short, in this hypothetical, there are now five different stakeholders who have 10 different roles. The second husband is a plaintiff in two malpractice claims and a defendant in two fee claims. Two law firm defendants are also plaintiffs in two fee claims and defendants in two malpractice claims, and of course, to insurers. So with that background, I'd like to tell you how this matter.
First of all, given the background, we have essentially the prospect of you having to herd a lot of cats and understand the interests of each of these parties in order to reach a resolution. Did you talk to the attorneys before the mediation session started?
I'm glad you've raised that, Len. My first step in any mediation is to make sure I've read the briefs carefully, understand the case from the briefs, and have a personal discussion with each of the attorneys to find out where the bodies are buried from their perspective and what their clients' real interests are. And out of those discussions, I can often flesh out suggestions by them as to how a resolution might be crafted, how dogged their client is in a particular position on a particular case, which is invaluable information in not only determining how to guide the parties to a resolution by negotiation, but to formulate reasonable mediators' recommendations and reasonable mediators' proposals.
In this particular case, you had, if I counted correctly, about five attorneys involved in this?
There were three law firms, plus an attorney for the plaintiff, so that would be four. So there would be four attorneys involved in the whole dispute. Each of the defendants were an attorney, and each of them had their own attorney. So the truth is, the answer is six, not four.
Okay, now you have to come up with a game plan, not just on how to settle the case, but who are you going to talk to first? What issues you're going to have to address first? And so you come up with that game plan. The parties have their own expectations going into all of this. So how many separate rooms did you set up?
Well, the mediation was in part by video and in part by mediation in individual rooms. And so therefore it was a combination, or what we call a hybrid mediation. And in that case, you would have three rooms, mm-hmm. For each of the defendant attorneys and one for the plaintiff. That would be adequate. And the insurers come into the defendants' rooms. In fact, what I often do in mediations, because insurers often appear by video, even if the parties show up in person, is arrange to have a laptop in the room of each of the attorneys that can be used by them to keep their insurer in communication throughout the entire mediation.
We're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, we're going to now Pat set the scene for everyone's either on Zoom or on in person, and they're all coming in with the idea of getting something done and having some of their needs met. I'm Len Levy. I'm talking with Pat Kelly on Masters of Dispute Resolution, and we'll be back in a moment.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California, leveraging technology to drive resolution. ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and I'm chatting with Pat Kelly, who is about to tell us how the mediation went. But before getting into how the mediation went, he's going to give some real thoughts on the value of preparation.
All right. Well, thank you, Len, and thank you again for raising the pre-meeting with the parties. In the process of the mediation, a very important factor is that the attorneys trust that the mediator, A, knows the case, and B, will exercise tempered and even-handed judgment in whatever direction the mediator gives in the process of the negotiation. And that's particularly important if you're going to be using mediators' recommendations or mediators' proposals, because the attorneys and the clients have to have confidence that you're fair, you've exercised good judgment. And I'll tell you why that's become particularly important in recent times. More and more mediators' proposals and mediators' recommendations are used in settlement conferences. And the fact is, no matter how much you tell the parties that this is not a substantive evaluation of the case, that it follows the traditional format, that all you're doing is probing the most that the defendant will pay and the least that the plaintiff will take to come to a recommendation, frankly, nobody believes that. what they believe is that you yourself, because of your experience, have put a substantive evaluation into the case that's baked in to your mediator's proposal. And that, of course, ups the ante or increases the duty on the attorney, on the mediator, not only to have thoroughly studied the case, but also to demonstrate that they've thoroughly studied it and exercised that judgment. That's why it's important to have read the briefs before you have the pre-mediation conference with the attorneys. And also in that pre-mediation conference, you will get a feel for the strength of the parties and various positions that they are taking in the mediation. It's fairly easy. Some of them are fairly easy to start with because you know when you're representing a professional, whether it's an attorney or an accountant or a director and an officer, they're going to take the position, I did nothing wrong from the outset, and pay me all my money. Any professional will do that. But you have to build the kind of relationship when they will listen to you when you say that it's better to compromise and get this over with now. So that relationship building starts with the pre-mediation conferences. And that's why they're so critical. Now, in this hypo, I concluded that the first thing I had to do was determine whether I could accomplish a one-size-fits-all settlement or whether I had to divide the parties up to limit the number of issues that are being handled with the most difficult party. Now, fortunately, in these cases, usually because of a case called Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, even though attorneys follow other attorneys, it's not that often that you have to deal with claims of indemnity by attorneys versus attorneys. It does happen, but in the particular hypothetical I'm working with today, it did not happen. And for that reason, it's possible to divide the parties. In that analysis, what I would usually look for is the easiest case to settle, to get it out of the way, to avoid the complication, to limit the issues we have to deal with, so that I can truly focus my time on the party that's going to be the most difficult to settle with. Here, that party would be law firm C. That is the law firm that represented the, in our hypothetical, represented the husband, number two, in litigation with the children. And that's a relatively easy claim. The claims weren't particularly meritorious, or let's say it another way, would be difficult to prove. And it's also early enough in the litigation that the amount of money that's been invested by either side or the amount of time that's been invested is relatively small, so that the economic value of an early settlement in terms of attorney's fees has a lot of pizzazz, shall we say, and would be very meaningful to insurers. So in this hypothetical, my approach was to get to the attorney C role, work with the insurer and counsel on both sides to come up with a resolution of that case by use of a mediator's recommendation. That mediator's recommendation was not accepted, but provided the groundwork for the parties to come close enough together to have a meaningful negotiation. And with that meaningful negotiation in a relatively short period of time, the parties could resolve the case even without a mediator's proposal. So do not underestimate the role of a mediator's recommendation.
Pat, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make sure you've mentioned now insurers, and the insurers I imagine would be the professional liability insurers we're talking about.
Correct.
When we have insurers involved, insurers are typically money. Okay. Were there issues in addition to the money that were that you had to deal with before you could even get those insurers on board with a recommendation?
Well, that's another good point that you have raised, Len. The fact is that oftentimes the existence of insurance is clouded by coverage disputes or coverage reservations. In this particular hypothetical, there were no coverage reservations. But in many, many cases I have, there are serious coverage reservations, and they need to be resolved either before or as a part of the mediation itself.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
That would add two more active parties to the negotiation. But here, the role of the insurer was to be a gatekeeper in terms of the amount of money they would pay with respect to the various malpractice claims. So therefore, they have a very important role, particularly since in this type of case, the net to the plaintiff is what is important. If the plaintiff settles a case with an attorney, but the attorney has not relinquished their claim of fees, that's a negotiation that has to happen as well. So there are two negotiations going in tandem in each of the hypothetical situations we're talking about here.
Got it. Okay.
So the goal was to resolve the smaller of the two cases and the one that I viewed as the better chance of an early settlement. And once that was done, then all of the mediator's attention and all of the parties' focus can be on the other case. In the other case, in this case, it was the attorney who drafted the subsequent or the second trust agreement. And also, in that case, then a lot of time was spent in negotiation, and a lot of time would be spent towards a mediator's recommendation, which may or may not be appropriate. In this particular scenario, a mediator's recommendation was appropriate. And through a back and forth of negotiation and the mediator's recommendations, I was able to craft a mediator's proposal that made sense and was accepted by both sides.
So you had a real feel, and you know what you're describing for those attorneys who think this mediation stuff is easy. There's a lot of hard work that goes into making a determination as to what to put in a mediator's proposal, a mediator's recommendation. And also often, and I didn't hear it in this case necessarily, but it could have been present, there may be emotional aspects of it that have to be overcome as well, not just the money. Am I correct that in this case it was about money?
Well, it was about money, but you made another good point. As I mentioned earlier, in any professional liability case, there are two things in play. The first is that the professional does not want to concede an error and oftentimes feels quite irate that there would be anyone claiming that they had erred. And that applies whether you're an accountant, a lawyer, a director, a fiduciary, whatever it is. The second thing is often in professional liability cases, the professional has a consent provision in their policy with the insurer, which applies in almost all medical malpractice cases. And in that case, you need to get the professional on board with the resolution before the insurer can pay dime one to anyone.
And the giving up of the I am wrong is often a very emotional experience, even for a professional.
Right. I think that is. Now, there are different rules that apply as to whether a malpractice result has to be reported. And those go beyond what we're discussing today.
Right.
Suffice it to say that there are ways to avoid that problem.
Okay, well, we're going to take another break right now. And when we get back to the last segment, we're going to be talking about what the resolution was in the case, what eventually was accepted by everyone to resolve this. And Pat will also provide you with some takeaways as to what you can learn in terms of mediation from this example. I'm Len Levy, and we'll be back with talking with Pat Kelly right after this.
Masters of Dispute Resolution is sponsored by the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals. NADN is the premier invitation-only association of civil mediators and arbitrators in the United States, with members in every state of the nation. Only experienced ADR professionals who are widely acceptable to local plaintiff and defense firms are invited to join the Academy's roster. The Academy's website, NADN.org, is the most widely visited neutrals database in the world today, with over 40,000 law offices, insurance companies, and corporations visiting our free website annually. Firms can search for neutrals by many criteria, including location, case expertise, qualifications, language skills, and most NADN members also publish their available dates, calendars, online, making NADN.org the go-to website for law firms wishing to schedule appointments online with their preferred mediators. For more information, please visit www.nadn.org today.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution and a chat with Pat Kelly, who has now conveyed the complexities of a of an incredible probate matter involving everything from malpractice to a bunch of issues that we still haven't gotten into, but Pat needed to overcome in order to settle this case, eventually resulting in a series of, if I'm hearing correctly, a series of mediators' proposals and mediators' recommendations. Is that correct?
That's correct. Absolutely. And the you asked me how the case was resolved. Mm-hmm. Frankly, that's confidential. But let's put it this way. Everyone walked away from the table, maybe not overjoyed, but at least comfortable with the resolution.
Okay.
All right.
Let's leave it at that.
Okay. The point was that as a mediator, you need to decide in your own mind that you're going to be fair from the outset to all parties. And my litmus test is, if I were in their seat, would I think this is fair? And I describe fair as a range of results. It's not one result, it's several results, but is this result within the range of fairness? And I never push a result that I don't believe is in that range. I've been asked, you asked about some tips, and I do have a couple. The first is that before embarking on using or dealing with mediators' proposals or mediators' recommendations, your audience should really read those code sections I cited earlier in my discussion, because they create an exception to the normal rule that everything that happens in a mediation is confidential. And that's found at Evidence Code 1119. And it's an ironclad rule, but the rules I talked about, Evidence Code 1123 and 1118, are exceptions to that. So it's important to understand how those work, whether you're encountering those as a mediator or as an attorney. Second thing, I'm often asked, what's the biggest mistake lawyers make in mediation? Well, frankly, dealing with the mediation hypothetical I'm talking about, it was an honor to deal with lawyers who were well prepared, and while they had strong feelings, were prepared to grapple with the issues and make principled decisions in the resolution and not fly off the handle at the mere fact that the other side says they're wrong. And that's an illustration of what I believe is the biggest mistake lawyers make in mediation, which is to not prepare for it with the seriousness that it deserves. Mediation is a chance to do discovery, Mediation is an opportunity to resolve the case. Mediation is a chance to sand out, shall we say, hurt feelings among either side. Mediation provides all those opportunities, and the benefit is to get to a result with certainty without the cost of litigation or continuing cost of litigation. The biggest mistake, therefore, lawyers make, I believe, with mediation is to not prepare for them with the seriousness that they deserve.
Let me just interject something here, because the seriousness means a lot of things to a lot of different people. Sometimes you get attorneys who will approach a mediation as an advocate, but an advocate as if they're arguing in court and being strong for their client, but without preparing by understanding what your client's interests are, what you're trying to advance, they're shortcutting their clients, or they're shortchanging, I should say, their clients by not really advancing what the clients need or want.
Oh, I think that's a good point, Len. I'd say it this way. Attorneys often come into a mediation with their client in the room with them. In fact, usually have their client in the room with them. That's one of the reasons that I spend so much time in pre-mediation discussions with attorneys, and also at least once or twice during a mediation ask for a private meeting just with the lawyer to see if there's some issue in play that they don't want to talk about in front of their client, but may provide a basis for resolution. The best example, that's one of the reasons, by the way, Len, that the joint sessions have fallen largely into disuse. Because I'm old enough to remember doing a lot of joint sessions, which was the state of the art at the time mediation began. And what it turned into often is an effort to demonstrate to a client that you could be tough and to take very firm positions with regard to issues that did nothing but embed those issues in the mind of those present in the room and make it that much more difficult to settle. For a lawyer to say X in a joint session and then have to tell their client, I really didn't mean it, is a tough pill for them to swallow. That's one of the reasons that I believe joint sessions are rarely valuable unless it's to introduce the parties, and that there has to be a clear line of communication between the lawyer and counsel. The different question is, should mediators talk to clients without the lawyer present? I generally will not do that. If a lawyer asks me to, I will. But in other circumstances, I don't believe that the parties can move in the same direction if you're not letting the attorney be privy to what their own client is saying to a mediator.
I've got to tell you, I've had some situations in which a client's wanted to speak to the other side without the attorney present. Those you have to be very, very careful with, because one of the things that you mentioned, Pat, that needs to be an element of mediation, and this is extremely important, is you do not want to lose the trust. You want to gain the trust of everyone participating in the process. You don't want to have situations in which the attorney and the client are at odds. And you certainly don't want to contribute to that.
Right. I agree with that. In fact, one offshoot of that is dealing with anger at a mediation. Anger by a client or anger with the attorney's advocacy. And the way I try to deal with it is to calm the situation down and point to the parties the reality that they wouldn't be in this room if they weren't here to do a deal. You cannot lead a horse to water if you're constantly throwing stones at them on the way to the trough. What you do need to show is that you're approaching this in a calm, reasonable way. There's another reason for that. You want the other side to believe that you'll try a case in a calm, dispassionate way that won't interfere with your ability to get the message to the trier of fact. So I just point out to people the fallacy in trying to take that approach in a mediation. Another thing that's related to that is making sure you pay attention to everyone in the mediation. I always make it a point to tell the parties that I believe they're the most important person in the mediation, not necessarily the lawyer.
What you're saying is reinforce the fact that in most cases, the parties are the only participants in that mediation that are personally affected by the result. The insurers are not going to be, the adjusters are not going to be personally affected unless they messed up in some way. But here you have people in the example that you gave who are inheriting money. How much money they get may depend on their circumstances, in terms of how flexible they are. Do they have a burning need for money at that particular point? But they are the ones who are going to be personally affected.
I think that's true. And I think that one thing attorneys need to be very attentive to is making sure that they're mediating with their clients' goals in mind. And I think that as an attorney, one thing I always focused on was that. As a mediator, I view my job as to find out what their true goals are and see how much I can deliver, what I can find in common with the other side, where I can find goals that each side has beyond simply resolving the case. And I try to work on those goals and use them to show the fallacy of letting the areas you disagree keeping you away from reaching a resolution because of the many areas in which you do agree.
And that is an extremely insightful statement, Pat, that there is a difference between settling a case and truly resolving a conflict. It enables the party to put that conflict behind him or her.
That's right. I think that's absolutely critical in the process, but that's kind of being a mediator 101, is that the basic goal is save money and put the conflict behind you and get on with your life. I approach every mediation exactly that way.
Well, Pat, thank you very much. I've got to tell you how delighted I am that we were able to do this today. This has been a great experience. I hope we can do it again sometime. I want to thank you for appearing here today. What is the best way for the parties to, anyone who wants to use your services as a mediator, arbitrator, as a referee, how should they contact you or your case manager?
Well, they would normally contact my case manager, who is Ella Fishman. I can give you that number right now, which would be the main ADR services number.
310-201-0010.
Or they can send me an email at pkelly@adrservices.com.
Thank you, Daryl Wayne, my engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infogen Labs, Inc. I hope you will continue to enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember that peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.